we pretty much, we do what we can in the best possibility as much as possible. 212-209-2950 or give to WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned for an expanded version of Off the Hook coming up real soon, but still pledge, call, and thank you for your support.
This is Savannah Baylor McLean, host of State of the Arts NYC. On Thursday, March 3rd, join WBAI and the West Harlem Art Fund at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. This will be in their new location at 58 West 129th Street off of Lenox Avenue for an intimate night of jazz in the Piano Lounge with a cocktail reception to follow. Featured artists are Daniel Schneider and Dave Taylor. This event benefits WBAI Pacifica Radio. Price is only $50. Go to give2wbai.org to purchase tickets. This event benefits WBAI Pacifica Radio and the good works that it does.
Hi friends, this is the information you've been waiting for. WBAI Latin Music Benefit Fundraiser will be held on April 1st at SOB's, 204 Varick Street in downtown Manhattan, and will be featuring the music of the Mambo Legends, formerly the Tito Puente Orchestra, with vocalist Cita Rodriguez, also myself, Chico Alvarez. I'll be performing with Conjunto Sabor, the U.S. debut of String Bembe with Tatiana Ferre and Daranil Gonzalez, and the SOB debut of Nahibe La Gitana and Orquesta Tribu. Doors open at 6 p.m. until 11.
A $25 donation will go straight to WBAI.
Tickets go on sale February 8th, available online at WBAI.org or SOB's upcoming events website.
Support Latin music shows New World Gallery and Con Sabor Latino every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 6 p.m.
on WBAI 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.
Hello, friends. Shake off your winter blues and join us on Sunday, February 21st from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Commons Cafe in Brooklyn, located at 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond, for a Con Sabor Latino special, Jam for Funds, on behalf of WBAI. Featuring the power salsa trio, Tres del Solar, this three-hour extravaganza will be simulcast on your favorite community radio station, WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. So, mark it on your calendar, tell a friend, and show your support. That's Sunday, February 21st, 3 to 6 p.m. at the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue, for Con Sabor Latino's Jam for Funds, featuring Tres del Solar. See you there.
Proud to present Lorraine Hansberry in her own words.
It was a privilege to have known Lorraine over a span of years. She had her roots deep in her people. As an artist, Lorraine reflected the life and struggles of our day.
The voice is the voice of Paul Robeson.
I happen to believe that most people, and this is where I differ from many of my contemporaries, I think that virtually every human being is dramatically interesting.
On Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m., during WBAI's February Fun Drive, OutFM will host a special on the life and work of Lorraine Hansberry. Included in the presentation will be selections from Robert Nimeroff's star-studded 1967 production, Lorraine Hansberry, in her own words.
Participating artists in this program are Betty Davis, Ruby Dee, Gloria Foster,
which includes selections from many of her plays,
Sidney Poitier.
And the time is just about 7:02. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM And it's time for another exciting edition, a special edition, a two-hour edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Bumpity bump for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. Bumpity bump.
Firefly here with you this evening, and I'm joined in the studio by Mike.
Hi there.
And on the telephone by Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia, Rob. I can barely hear you and Mike, so if you can turn up what I hear, that would be great.
I'll do what I can.
Thank you.
Such excitement. So yes. Many knobs to turn.
So many knobs, so many buttons. This is a special episode tonight. Emmanuel and Kyle are away on assignment, and in lieu of their presence, we're just going to offer you more of ourselves. I think this will work out for for all concerned.
It's going to work out especially well, I hope, for our audience who get to hear us for 2 hours tonight. We should let them know in advance that this is we'll be doing some fundraising. If you want to get the jump on that and pledge right now, 212-209-2950. Or give to WBAI.org, that's the numeral 2, and you can show your support for us, for this radio station, and reduce the amount of times we have to ask you for money in the future. But we're with you for 2 hours tonight, and I think it's good because we have a lot to cover. A lot has happened since we were last on the air.
A whole lot has happened. It's been 2 weeks. We have an exciting piece of news to start off with. We'll start with some good news.
Does Emmanuel know we're going to do good news in his absence?
Yeah, I'm thinking of shaking things up. You know, he might fire me when he gets back. But
I'll
deal with that. I'll deal with that as it comes. Now, we have a bit of good news for regarding our Hope Convention, Hackers on Planet Earth, which is happening this July, New York City's own hacker conference, and we have announced our first keynote. Who is our first keynote? Bernie S., who is our first keynote?
Cory Doctorow, esteemed science fiction author whose work I enjoy, will be one of presumably three keynotes at the 11th Hope this July 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. I'm very excited.
For people who are not familiar with his work, what's so good about it?
Well, it's funny. First of all, Corey has a sense of humor.
I was hoping for a little more specificity there, Bernie.
it pertains to it has some technological wisdom to it. I don't want to call it wisdom, but a lot of the stuff he writes about is stuff that is plausible, and for a science fiction author to write what he writes, you'd have to understand current technologies pertaining to the internet and a lot of other things that we talk about on this show. So it's really apropos that he would speak at the 11th Hope, because I think there's a lot of overlap between the hacker community and the science fiction fan community.
Right, and Cory Doctorow's work especially applies to the hacker community. He comes from that sort of place himself. He's if people know his work, his journalistic work at the site Boing Boing, which is the extension of an old cyberpunk zine from back in the day. And also just his work tends to involve a lot of the hacker outlook, the hacker spirit. And he actually joined us on this show quite a while back, November of 2009. We interviewed him about what was then his new book, Makers, which dealt with a lot of sort of hacker community issues and was a not too distant future based on what was going on in the maker scene and the 3D printing scene and in sort of the intellectual property scene. I liked the book a lot. And yeah, so he actually even wrote an article for 2600 magazine back in the day,
but under a pseudonym, as many of us have done.
Under a pseudonym, and
can we out him and say which article it was?
I don't think we have that information handy, but we can just claim it was whichever one you liked that you read back in the day. It might have been him. But yeah, so we're excited about that. The first of our three keynote speakers at the upcoming 11th Hope.
Can we say this is a keynote speech that has been literally decades in the making?
It has.
We've been trying to get Cory Doctorow to speak at the Hope Conference for many, many conferences, and he's wanted to come, but there's been scheduling conflicts and this, that, and the other. So I'm glad that was finally able to be resolved, and he will be speaking this July.
Right. He's a tricky fella to pin down. Actually, when we interviewed him for the show, he was living in the UK, and the way the times lined up, I ended up like staying up really late one night so I could call him when it was convenient for him, and we pre-recorded the interview. But he was very accommodating, and you know, good guy to speak with. If you're interested, you can still if you go back to November 2009 on the Off the Hook archives on 2600.com, you can listen to that interview. Or you could also check out the things he's into on the sites Boing Boing, and as well as his personal site, which is craphound.com. Lots of interesting stuff there. He actually writes free books. He's a proponent of free culture, open culture, as I am, and I really dig his work for that. So yeah, he writes these great books, these chart making books, and then he releases them for free reading for the public.
You can also buy them if that's your thing.
You can also buy them, yes. And there have been all sorts of adaptations made and remixes of his work and really cool stuff. So yeah, Cory Doctorow is the first of our keynote speakers at the 11th Hope.
So what if I want to get like a taste of what Hope will be like? Is there a way to do that, Rob?
A taste of what Hope will be like? Well, I can suggest that you get hold of maybe some Hope archives on possibly DVDs or thumb drives.
So this is not a recording of the conference to come, because that we don't have a time machine.
Indeed.
So Cory Doctorow will not be in it. But
Cory Doctorow will not, but others like him and others you may be interested in hearing from will be.
How do I get this wonderful package?
Well, if you can get these wonderful packages if you go to give2wbai.org. And the pledge levels are not in front of me because I've just lost my connection.
So I believe if you pledge $50, you'll get a package of DVDs of the Hope X, which is the conference from, I guess, a year and a half ago at this point. If you pledge $75, you'll get every single talk from that conference on a thumb drive that you can plug into your computer. You can watch anywhere you want. And 212-209-2950 if you're a fan of telephones. Give to WBAI.org if you're a fan of websites. You can try both at the same time and see which one's faster. But do it today, and we'll be able to send you these premiums as a thank you gift. In the case of the thumb drive, you literally cannot get anywhere else. In the case of the DVDs, if you tried to get it anywhere else, it would cost you far more than $50. But what we're happy to do for you is to donate these to the station as a thank you for your supporting us, for keeping this radio program on the air, for keeping this radio station on the air for all these years. We literally have no other source of revenue. And to be clear, none of us will see a dime of this money, but the station needs your money to make sure the studio continues to exist, make sure our transmitter continue to exist. And we can't do it without your support. We don't want to go down the route that so many other shows do and be telling you things you should buy, services you should use in exchange for money. We want to be able to maintain our editorial independence. And the only way we can do that is to remain solely accountable to you, our audience. And so if you like this show, vote with your dollars if you can afford it. 212-209-2950, give to WBAI.org.
That was really well said, Mike. I couldn't have said it better, but
why don't you try?
I want to add to what you said, and that is that anyone who supports this station tonight or anytime by calling 212-209-2950 can not only be satisfied that you're keeping this radio station and this radio show on the air, and get an amazing thank you gift that is worth far more than what you're pledging financially, but you will have a say in what happens at WBAI. You will become a voting member of this community supported station. You'll be part of the network. You will be able to express your wishes as to, I like this show, I don't like this show, I wish you would do more of this, I wish you'd do less of this, all of that. You will be part of the community of WBAI, which is an amazing community, and is frankly priceless.
Indeed, it is, and you know, we won't go on about this for the entire show. We have some news to talk about as well, but we do want to remind our listeners that, as Mike said, this is the only thing that keeps us on the air. We don't accept paid advertising. We're not funded by any vested interests of that tell us what we can and can't do.
We don't take government money. Nope. We don't get large foundation grants. You, our audience, are the source of support, the only source of support. And so if you want us to continue, give us a call.
Yes, indeed. And I do now have those pledge levels in front of me. And yes, for a pledge of $50, you can get the Hope Archives DVD collection, a package of some of the best keynote talks and some other talks from the Hope Conference. And if you would like to pledge a little more, $75, you will get a thumb drive containing the keynotes and other selected talks from the Hope Conferences. In perfectly DRM-free, watchable digital files that you can then transfer to whatever devices and things that you want to. So very cool stuff. We also have a bit of artwork by somebody whose work I enjoy very much. Okay, it's me. we have some paintings. A while back, I offered some paintings to our supporters for $50 each, a 5x7 painting on acrylic. I did a set of luminaries of the hacker world, which were portraits of all sorts of fascinating people from history who espouse the hacker spirit in some way. I did 14 of these, and there is one left. There is a single one left. So if you would like to snap up that last one, go to give2wbai.org or call 212-209-2950.
So that's a thing you should do right now.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And for a pledge of $50 and ask for the Luminaries of the Hacker World painting, the very last one we have. There's also another set of paintings that I'm currently doing, which are historical and interesting telephones. Again, 5x7 on stretched canvases, which you can also get for a pledge of $50. Ask for the historical telephones painting. I've gotten some very nice comments from listeners and supporters who've gotten hold of these and occasionally showed me pictures of where they have them displayed, which is very cool. Also, if you have any of this stuff that you've gotten from us, please share with us how you display or use or enjoy them.
Rob, what is a historical telephone?
A historical telephone is just particular telephones from the history of the telephone that are.
You have to use different words.
Yeah. So I could use different words, but the words that you need to use if you want these on the site or on the phone are historical telephones.
Maybe give an example.
An example is the most recent one I did was actually a telephone prototype done by a German scientist named Philip Rice before Alexander Graham Bell's telephone, which became all the rage. So it's a painting of that device, which is very, very cool looking, very interesting looking. And a kind of little known footnote in the history of telecommunications. I'm pretty happy with how that one turned out. I'm working on a couple others. There's an interesting phone booth I'm working on. There is the Western Electric 500, which is a very classic model of telephone, which if you were alive at a certain point during history, you would know this as sort of a basic telephone that you saw everywhere. Nowadays, you don't see very many of them, unless you hang around with the people I do. But particularly interesting phones. I'm working on one of this may be stretching the definition of a bit, but the Blue Box that Steve Jobs and Wozniak made in the 60s. One of those is in a museum, and I'm painting that. So, yeah, if you call 212-209-2950, pledge $50 for a historical telephone painting, or the very last Hacker Luminary painting, or the Hope Archive DVD, Either of those you can get for $50, or for a pledge of $75, you can get the Hope Archives on a thumb drive. Or for just any pledge above for $25 and up, you can get not these premiums, but you will get membership in the station and say in what goes on here. And you can go online at any time or call up at any time and ask which other premiums the station has. Just make sure you specify that you're donating toward your favorite show, which we hope is Off the Hook. It's certainly my favorite. And go from there. And thank you very much for your support.
Hey, Rob, I enjoyed a listener email we got recently, the gentleman apologized for stealing one of your paintings. he said he only had to pledge $50 to WBA to support WBAI, and he got this amazing portrait of a luminary from the hacker world. Mm-hmm. That was 5x7 and stretch canvas, beautiful. Like, I've seen these on your website. They're really extremely well done. With a mm-hmm. isn't there a little a tag on the bottom explaining who it is and why they're a luminary?
Yep, every one of these paintings, the luminaries and also the telephones, will get a little placard that goes with it that tells you what it is that it's being portrayed and what significance it has to hacker history. And I was very happy to get that email. There's actually a particular listener who's pledged for multiple ones of these, and I think is building up a collection, which I'm incredibly flattered by. But yeah, so
I mean, if you agree, audience, with that listener who feels that $50 is not enough for one of Rob's paintings, and quite frankly, I agree, you're certainly welcome to pledge more. If you're not in a situation to be able to do that, your pledge of $50 will get you an original painting. Do that. I know someone who, as a commercial enterprise, was commissioning paintings mm-hmm. Done at minimum wage in China, and the retail cost is more than $50. And they were not nearly as good as Rob's work or as interesting. So to be able to pledge $50 and not only keep us on the air, but also get an original artwork in exchange is just an amazing offer. I think they're going to go fast. You should give us a call, 212-209-2950. Go to give2wbai.org and claim your painting.
Yeah, I to toot my own horn, I am a professional artist, and I do commissioned work. And for the work that that you're getting in these paintings, I should point out that, yeah, $50 is significantly less than I would actually charge in real life. But
and when you do that, it doesn't come with a radio station.
It certainly doesn't. And I've donated these to the radio station so we can offer them to you at this reduced price to support, because I think it's important to support this show and this station and these listeners who have all given me a really good home over the years I've been involved. And I like being able to give back a little. So call 212-209-2950 or go to give2wbai.org and show your support. So a lot has gone on in the world for the past couple of weeks while we've been off the air. We have some extra time to talk about it. We'll be on for 2 hours tonight. To start with, this Apple story that we've been hearing about.
We could easily spend 2 hours on this story. It's so important.
We could. So apparently, according to a federal judge who ruled on this yesterday, Apple must help the FBI break into an iPhone because it happens to have belonged to one of the killers in the recent shootings in San Bernardino. Let's see, the ruling from U.S. Magistrate, this from USA Today, the ruling from U.S. Magistrate Sherry Pim requires Apple to provide, quote, reasonable technical assistance to the FBI, namely software that can disable the security feature that erases data from the iPhone after too many unsuccessful attempts to unlock it. Federal prosecutors told the court they could not access the phone used by Farouk, the shooter, because they don't know his passcode. With the security feature disabled, they could attempt as many combinations as they like to unlock the iPhone. Now, I there are things about this that are particularly dangerous. What do you think, Bernie?
Well, the shooter you just mentioned and his wife were both allegedly involved with this incident. They're both dead. Mm-hmm. So I don't know who the FBI hopes to prosecute from this. But that aside, this what the FBI is trying to compel Apple to do by using its influence with the courts is to create a piece of software that would allow the FBI to basically hack into not just this iPhone, which is what the Department of Justice or FBI has been falsely claiming. This is just for this one phone. Well, no. They could use the same piece of software to hack into a lot of iPhones, presumably without even getting a warrant. It wouldn't be legal, but it wouldn't be hardly the first time the FBI has violated the law to hack into a computer without a warrant. This reminds me a lot of, remember back in the early 90s, there was a big FBI initiative for something called the Communications Act for Law Enforcement Assistance. Do you remember that, Rob?
It rings a bell.
Well, this is the CODIA Act.
I'm sure Mike remembers it. That was the FBI's first, I think, shot across the bow of telecommunications privacy on a grand scale. And the CODIA bill, which actually was passed into law in late 94, required all telephone companies to provide access to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies so they could just go in at will and wiretap phone calls. This reminds me, this new initiative by the FBI that we're learning about just yesterday and today reminds me a lot of CODIA, because it's sort of like the first step of the slippery slope to the FBI having another tool that they can just bypass our privacy, frankly, whether or not they have a warrant. They're going to do what they want, but they can't do what they want right now without this piece of software they're trying to get Apple to write for them. So I'm really very much against this.
Yeah, that's an important point. The software they want does not yet exist. They want Apple to create the software for them.
Which is almost the nuttiest part of the whole thing. They want to compel Apple, some engineers at Apple, to work against the other Apple engineers who are trying to prevent people from being able to break into iPhones they don't own. It would really be quite an interesting dynamic at the company if this sort of thing were to happen. We should be clear, Bernie, that the specific order here claims that the FBI wrote this order, obviously, and then the judge struck the word "proposed" off of it and signed it, which is a fairly standard practice. Although one would hope they'd give a little more thought for such groundbreaking orders as this one. The order does request a specific piece of software that can only break into this iPhone. Those of us who are more technically minded doubt that such a thing could ever really exist.
Right.
That you can have a software that can only break into one iPhone. Mm-hmm. It's clear that, this is something that the FBI has wanted for a long time, and it's clear that they've gone for the case where they think they can get it. They've got a mass murderer who's Muslim, so they're calling him a terrorist. I don't really know any other definition of terrorist. And they're saying, we need to get into this guy's iPhone. He's dead, so he can't let us in. We need in. And so this is, as compelling a case as the government's ever going to have, although, in my view, still not terribly compelling. And they are demanding that Apple produce this software that will let them into it. But the thing is, if they get their way this time, they're going to get their way again. They're going for precedent here. I don't even know to what degree they care about this particular phone, because, as you said, the suspect is already dead. They can't really prosecute him.
Yeah, and it is obvious that there is no such thing as a thing that will just work on the one phone, because you can't make cookies that you can only bake in one brand of oven. You can't make software that will only work on one example of it. And even if they could, it would just be precedent for them to do the same thing over again the next time somebody wants to look at a phone that's not theirs. So the implications of this are troubling, and this ruling has brought in responses from every corner of the internet, including Tim Cook himself, the CEO of Apple, who writes on apple.com/customer-letter, a long open letter response.
Is this the first time Apple has ever written a letter to their customers or
something?
Apparently,
because the URL was available on apple.com. Reading an excerpt from this letter by Tim Cook. Specifically, the FBI wants us to make a new version of the iPhone operating system, circumventing several important security features, and install it on an iPhone recovered during the investigation. In the wrong hands, this software, which does not exist today, would have the potential to unlock any iPhone in someone's physical possession. The FBI may use different words to describe this tool, but make no mistake, building a version of iOS that bypasses security in this way would undeniably create a backdoor. And while the government may argue that its use would be limited to this case, there is no way to guarantee such control. Some would argue that building a backdoor for just one iPhone is a simple, clean-cut solution, but it ignores both the basics of digital security and the significance of what the government is demanding in this case. Skipping forward a bit, the government is asking Apple to hack our own users and undermine... Wait, they use the word hack. The government is asking Apple to hack our own users and undermine decades of security advancements that protect our customers, including tens of millions of American citizens, from sophisticated hackers and... sophisticated hackers... and cyber criminals. Yeah, they could have just said cyber criminals there, but no. The government is asking Apple to hack their own users and undermine the advancements that protect them from sophisticated hackers. And I'm enjoying this letter less now. But the same engineers who built strong encryption into the iPhone to protect our users would, ironically, be ordered to weaken those protections and make our users less safe. We can find no precedent for an American company being forced to expose its customers to a greater risk of attack. For years, cryptologists and national security experts have been warning against weakening encryption. Doing so would only hurt the well-meaning and law-abiding citizens who rely on companies like Apple to protect their data. Criminals and bad actors will still encrypt using tools that are readily available to them. So, yeah, it goes on like that a bit. But, yeah, Apple's boss himself doesn't think this is such a good idea.
Hey, Rob, did Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, did he forget that the Apple's two co-founders, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, were both hackers and phone freaks and proud of it? And had they not been, they would not have been able to even start Apple Corporation? I mean, I think there's a certain irony here.
Yeah, it is the company that blue boxed.
Is this really what we're going to focus on, guys?
So, well, here's the thing. This issue... with this FBI trying to compel Apple to write this piece of software to hack into iPhones, it has now become a campaign issue in presidential politics. The leading Republican, I won't even mention his name, everybody knows who he is, the leading Republican candidate for the president of the United States is saying, who do they think they are about Apple? They should just open it up, he says. And this candidate says, I think overall, security overall, we have to open it up and we have to use our heads. We have to use common sense. Well, frankly, this so-called self-described common sense conservative who's leading the Republican Party to down the tubes is common sense, I don't think, is part of his M.O., although I think he is a pretty brilliant guy when it comes to knowing what people will go along with. And I think a lot of what scares me is I think a lot of people are going to go along with this.
Bernie, I don't know if you saw any statements from anyone else taking the opposite position, though. I mean, plenty of people in the industry and in the general public are, of course, opposed to this radical move by the government. I did see a statement from Ron Wyden, who is the senator who we've talked about before, who's probably the best on a lot of these privacy issues, opposing the government's move here. But I don't think there's a presidential candidate I can vote for that shares my view.
On this issue?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Although I haven't heard, I have not read any verbiage from any other presidential candidate this season who's chimed in on this. Oh, but I bet they all will be asked to chime in on it by the press, I hope. Because I'd like to know where these people who want to be the president of the United States stand on these really important personal privacy issues.
I mean, they're going to try and weasel their way out of saying anything. I just want to read a bit of Ron Wyden's statement because he deserves the credit for trying to put a stop to this kind of thing. He says that the unprecedented reading of a nearly 230-year-old law, which is the law they found that they claim allows them to do this, would create a dangerous precedent that would put at risk the foundations of strong security for our people and privacy in the digital age. If upheld, this decision could force U.S. technology companies to actually build hacking tools for government against their will while weakening cybersecurity for millions of Americans in the process. And then he raises the point that I think is also key, which is that, furthermore, this move by the FBI could snowball around the world. Why in the world would our government want to give repressive regimes in Russia and China a blueprint for forcing American companies to create a backdoor? Companies should comply with warrants to the extent that they are able to do so, but no company should be forced to deliberately weaken its products. In the long run, the real losers will be Americans' online safety and security. You know, like, I could do with a little less jingoism with that statement, but I think it raises... a key point, which is that if the U.S. government gets its way on this, other governments are going to be demanding this kind of backdoor or stronger backdoors to be able to monitor all communications without individualized warrants. And Apple's would have no leg to stand on if they complied with U.S. government orders, but not orders from other governments. So it's really a thing that needs to be stopped now before it goes any further, in my view.
Mike, do you think if Apple complied with this order or was forced to, they had like what, a week to respond to the government to the court's request and say this is a burden that we really can't, it's an undue burden or something. Do you think that Apple, if they have to do this, if they're compelled to by the court and they write this piece of software, that other major markets like China, where Apple presumably makes billions of dollars selling iPhones, if the country said, hey, Apple, we want you to do this for us here in this country so we can hack into our own citizens' iPhones, do you think Apple would just say, oh, no, we're not going to do that. We don't need your billions of dollars anymore. What do you think would happen there?
I'm sure they would, you know, try and fight it. They're given 5 days to combat the order, but I'm sure the legal process will go on for longer than 5 days. They just get 5 days to file their, you know, initial objections. The thing about this case is they're prosecuting someone who's already dead, so there's no real hurry for anyone, which is nice because it gives time for the arguments to be thought out. But no, of course not. You know, the Chinese government is going to want whatever the U.S. government gets. And, like, why shouldn't they have it? There's no real good reason. Apple does a lot of retail sales in China. They do all of their manufacturing in China. They really would have no leg to stand on to deny the Chinese government what they've given the U.S. government. And we know from previous cases that the Chinese government is very cautious to ask for, you know, just like whatever other governments get. Systems they build themselves, of course, they do all kinds of crazy things with. But when making demands from American or multinational corporations, they have shown they will ask for, you know, they will use the argument. They are not at all afraid to use the argument. Hey, you gave this to the U.S. government. We're a country, too. Why shouldn't we have it? And I am sure they will do so in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I wish I had more to say on the topic, but it seems completely unambiguous to me.
That it does.
Well, I don't know if we're going to have time later in this two-hour show to hear what our listeners say about this, but I'm really interested. I've had numerous friends ask me about this issue today. Did you hear about this? Yeah, I heard about it. And a lot of people are talking about this, and I hope a lot more people talk about this, because this is a really critical issue pertaining to our communications privacy. You know, it's frankly, it's going to be up to the court, but I do think that the U.S. courts do sometimes look at public opinion, and if there's a sufficient outrage, sometimes the courts go the other way. We'll have to see what happens here. I think Mike's right that this is going to drag on a lot longer than a week.
Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever the ruling is in response to the papers filed in 5 days, you know, whoever loses is going to appeal. We can be almost certain about that.
And this might go all the way. This could very well go all the way to Supreme Court. We'll have to see. You know, what happens in the courts is really important to our electronic privacy. So we should keep a close eye on this case, and we'll be talking about it in a couple of weeks when we're back on the air.
Mm-hmm. The letter from Tim Cook emphasizes again and again that apparently Apple believes that the FBI is, you know, means well with what they're trying to do, but just the manner in which they're doing it is all wrong. And that's kind of an interesting tack for them to take, because, you know, I personally don't assume that the FBI means well with everything it does. I think sometimes they want to do things that are wrong, and they want to find reasons that are justifiable in the eyes of whoever they're answerable to, in order to allow them to do these things. And I think we're looking at that case right now. So, yeah, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on this.
The statement was signed by Tim Cook. I'm sure he agrees with its content, but it was almost certainly reviewed, if not written by a lawyer, and saying, you know, we think the FBI is a big bunch of idiots is not a really a winning publicity strategy, unfortunately.
Someday I hope to have my own multinational mega corporation so I could use it to say, yeah, I think you guys are full of crap.
So, Bernie, I wonder what you think of this. Do you think the FBI actually needs this software, or they could get into the phone without it?
Well, I think, and I emailed you guys earlier today about this, I think the FBI has access to tools already that would allow them to clone the entire contents of the phone, encrypted as it may be, and make as many duplicate phones with the same content in it as this one they're trying to hack into. So I think there's, you know, they could do this. It would be a lot harder. I think they're just looking for a really easy solution that they can apply this piece of software just to all iPhones or a lot of other iPhones to do this. So, yeah, I think they could get around this. They're looking, I think they're very clever in some ways. They are idiots, but in that same way, they're also very clever. I think, Mike, that they were looking, as you said, they were looking for a case that would have a strong emotional appeal to people. People like the leading Republican candidate who says, who do these guys think they are? This is, they're very good at picking test cases, the FBI, and I think that they could get this information other ways without getting this piece of software, but they want this piece of software written for them so they can do way more surveillance on more iPhones.
On the subject of personal privacy, sometimes you don't need to get the FBI to crack their way into people's devices in order to make use of personal information about them, because sometimes people give up that information willingly. A story from The Independent in the UK talks about something called crowd emotion, which is a face scanning technology that the BBC has been playing with, the BBC being the British Broadcasting Corporation, which sheds light on viewers' tastes by analyzing their facial expressions as they watch content.
How does it see the people's faces?
It sees the people's faces with cameras pointed at the people. This is just in the testing phase, apparently.
Ah, okay.
So these people consented to sitting in front of cameras and, I guess, watching television. And facial movements are recorded on a second-by-second basis, and the results are divided into six possible emotions: sadness, puzzlement, happiness, fear, rejection, and surprise.
So the BBC has identified the only six possible human emotions. That's really the groundbreaking research here, Rob. I don't know why we're focusing on the other stuff.
There's only six.
Very, very good work by the BBC on this. Like, they have Doctor Who in this. This is, you know, it's a triumph. The cameras allow researchers to measure the often subconscious responses people have to visual content. A pilot experiment measuring 5,000 people's conscious and subconscious emotional responses to marketing campaigns on the BBC.com website from clients including HSBC has proved a success, BBC Worldwide said. So they're testing people's responses not only to the shows that they make, because they're an entity that produces entertainment, but to sponsored content, to ads. This can be a little bit scary. I don't know.
But the BBC didn't have ads.
No, apparently they have marketing campaigns on their website, which is what this was analyzing. So facial coding showed a 77% increase in, quote, explicit positivity toward the brand's advertising, and a 14% increase in, quote, subconscious positivity when it was clearly marked as sponsored content. And, you know, usually as somebody who watches a certain amount of television produced by the BBC, they're usually the ones that you go to if you want content that's free of such entanglements, because they're a public entity that has this remit to make content and not submit to paid advertising like this. So to see this coming from anyone is a bit scary, but to see it coming from them is a bit extra troubling, I think.
Is this a segue into the source of content and information that doesn't do this sort of thing to its audience?
I think a source of content like that would be a valuable thing. Do you know anybody who
I do
that?
Know one. I really only know of one, which is Pacifica and WBAI, which is a part of it, that takes no money from advertisers. We don't have the budget for this kind of facial tracking study, and if we did have the budget, we'd spend it on something else.
Yeah, we have better things to do than watch you through the radio.
And if you want to keep us that way, or keep us in existence, because the only way we'll stay in existence is, honestly,
212-209-2950 is the number to call. Give2wbai.org is the website to visit. We have all kinds of premiums to thank you for your support, and we promise not to videotape your reaction to any of them.
Nope. If you want to send us a videotape of your reaction, that's fine. That's on you. But
yeah, I mean, and we'll look at it, but we won't send it to a computer to analyze.
We could speculate about the emotional and facial physiological emotional expressions of our listeners who call 212-209-2950 when they get this amazing package of 100 Hope DVDs, Hope X DVDs.
Wait, I'm
for
sorry,
only $50.
100?
I mean, I can just imagine the look on people's faces when they open this box and there's 100 DVDs in there and they realize, I got this for $50. This is great. I'm going to be watching this for months of great material or on a flash drive for $75. Or looking at one of, Rob's amazing, paintings of luminaries of the hacker world or historical interesting telephones for only $50. I'll bet there's going to be a lot of happy faces.
Yeah, you know, you reminded me. I don't think we mentioned that before, but yeah, it is 100 DVDs you would be getting for a pledge of $50, which is that also is considerably less than we would charge if you were just buying the DVDs of Hope Talks from us in the normal fashion in which they're offered. So yeah, call 212-209-2950 or go to give2wbai.org and get an instant library of amazing amounts of Hope content. Either on physical media, on DVDs, if you still like discs, as I do, or on a convenient thumb drive, which you can take anywhere and plug into your various devices.
A thumb drive is for a pledge of $75, am
yes,
I
indeed.
Right?
Yes, indeed. $50 for the DVDs, $75 for the Hope thumb drive, or a pledge of $50 for either the last remaining Hacker Luminary painting or one of the 10 remaining historical telephone paintings. 212-209-2950 or give2wbai.org. If you're listening to this in the mysterious future on a podcast or an MP3 or whatever comes after that, you can still probably go to give2wbai.org and see how you can support Off the Hook. If there are any of these left, grab one. If there aren't, there might be something else. Or you could just show your support in general. You could also become a BAI buddy and become a recurring automatic donor, which comes with its own other set of benefits and rewards. So go to give2wbai.org or call 212-209-2950 if you're interested in that. Ask about the BAI Buddy program, and you will be informed on all the goodies that come with that.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we don't talk a lot about the BAI Buddy program, but it is really quite an amazing thing. We just deduct a small amount of money every month from your bank or credit card or however it works, and we know we can count on your recurring support that way. So we spend less time asking you for money, and you barely notice the pinch on your bank account every month because it's just a few dollars a month. But then at the end of the year, you know, it's tax time. You'll get a receipt in the mail saying how much you've given and how much you've helped to keep us on the air. And it really makes a huge difference if you're in a position to be able to do that kind of thing. And I think a lot of people are. 212-209-2950 or give2wbai.org to sign up for the WBAI Buddies program and really, you know, ensure your continued support into the future. It's a really great program if you can do that.
That indeed. So moving on to, because what we do here is we share information, and we share information for free. We don't charge you to listen to us. You don't have to buy a new radio or subscribe to any service to listen to WBAI. We're here for everybody, and we share what we do freely, and that's something that we think is very important here. And along those lines, there has been something very interesting happening in the world of scientific research. A website called SciHub, that's sci-hub.io, was started by someone named Alexandra Elbakyan, who's a neuroscientist from Kazakhstan, who is now based in Russia. And what this site purports to be is the Pirate Bay for scientists.
So it's like Darwin's Beagle or something? The ship, the Beagle, it just floats around and they do science on it?
Even better than
piratey science? How does it work?
They put an eye patch on the Beagle. No, what they do is they are the Pirate Bay, which, of course, is a website that offers various files that people upload as free downloads.
Oh, wait, I know. Research into the best shape for a cutlass?
I think that's an interesting tack we could take. That maybe needs more research. I think we need to focus on that a bit at another time. But right now, the Pirate Paper Scientists, what Sci-Hub is a hub where peer-reviewed academic papers, which are normally something shared in various ways, including very expensive subscription-based scientific journals, Sci-Hub wants to share these for free, similar to how the Pirate Bay shares various media. So Alexandra Albakian runs Sci-Hub and, yeah, is putting a great deal of scientific research, a lot of it publicly funded stuff that should be, a lot of people believe, free to begin with, up for public download. Just putting it out there for anyone who's interested, without needing to buy the papers originally. According to this article on the International Business Times, these papers could retail for up to $30 each,
Which is insane. By the way, $30 for a single scientific paper might be worth it if the $30 went to the authors of that paper or something. But in general, it doesn't.
Particularly because a lot of the scientific work was financed with public money. Mm-hmm. So, and now the public can't even read them for free, where their tax dollars are used to finance this scientific research. Rob, is this similar to what Aaron Swartz was trying to accomplish
with the JSTOR documents? There are parallels to be drawn there because, again, Aaron Swartz was taking scientific research and journals and data that he felt should be shared for free, and just downloading them en masse with credentials that he had. That he had access to, and with the eye toward resharing them.
To be clear, there is a difference here in that he did not redistribute the papers, and this website claims to do so.
Mm-hmm. Nope, this website is basically completing, I think, what he wanted to do, but didn't get the chance. And Albakian started this site because to get through her own thesis, according to this article from IB Times, Albakian was forced to download pirated versions of the academic papers for free that she needed, and eventually, after being introduced to a website that enabled researchers to share and trade their academic papers among themselves, she decided to take the idea further and create Sci-Hub. The journals themselves, things like using a proxy at a university can get you access to these things because it looks like you're coming from an institute of learning. Or other things, and people are getting hold of these and resharing them, and this is a very interesting development, I think, because the scientific world is normally seen, I think, in the public sphere as something that's sort of very buttoned down and formal, and things are done in certain ways, and this seems to throw a monkey wrench in some of that.
So Rod, let me get this straight. Tell me if this is how this works. If I'm a scientific researcher, mm-hmm. and I work at a university,
yes.
The university very very likely has an account with a company like Elsevier, who then gets an unlimited account. So as a researcher for working for a university who paid for an unlimited account through Elsevier, you can download all the academic papers you need to do your research. Mm-hmm. It's like buying them in bulk. As a subscription, but a lot of these researchers think this is ridiculous that other people have to pay money, so they're then sharing their university credentials to access Elsevier and other sites to get these documents. They're sharing them with this Sci-Hub thing,
yes.
And now everybody can use these, as you said, proxies to access these accounts. I imagine the company who's making a lot of money selling these, I think unethically selling these research papers, they're probably hopping mad about this.
It's a possibility, and this is a feature apparently of the Sci-Hub website itself. Which, when you search through them for a paper, that's when the website looks for paths that it can use to download it for free, like through university proxies and things like that, taking advantage of the standing subscriptions that such places have, but sharing it with a different end user, that being the user of Sci-Hub. At its peak in 2015, the website received 80,000 visitors a day, according to Nature magazine, and was so popular that an academic publisher called Elsevier, I think I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, possibly, but this publisher brought a copyright lawsuit against the website, claiming it had lost between $75,000 and $150,000 in revenue due to the piracy. Of course, the actual cash figures always attached to piracy are routinely inflated. We've seen that time and again by entities like the MPAA or RIAA, claiming they lost all kinds of money to piracy that wouldn't actually have translated to actual sales if the piracy weren't available. But
I mean, yeah, it seems extremely unlikely that any percentage of this revenue would actually have been booked by this publisher had the piracy website not existed. Very few individuals are ever going to pay $30 for a single scientific paper. Almost all scientific papers that are paid for are done through institutional subscriptions. And I know I've occasionally want to read a paper or something, and if I can find it for free, which I often can, either on the author's website or however, then I do so. But if I end up at a dead end and I have to pay $30, I would never do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I live in the United States. I have $30. Lots of people in the world do not have $30, and it's just not even an option for them to pay for a single paper, let alone an option they don't take. So I think these lost revenue numbers are entirely incredible.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this, too, is, of course, the existence of Sci-Hub is owes a great deal to the active participation of members of the scientific community themselves. It's the scientists doing this. It's not somebody like from outside that world busting in and doing this stuff. It's the people themselves. It's the community itself doing that. That's doing this work and that's using this work and reusing it and benefiting from it. They're the ones that that are agreeing that maybe these things shouldn't go for $30 a pop and they should be publicly available. And so since the injunctions and things started coming down, the site has moved onto what's colloquially known as the dark web.
What does that mean?
The dark web is basically an internet a chunk of the internet, if you will, that that is exclusive to people using certain privacy enhancing technologies. Such as Tor. And the funny thing is that to get to this, you need to go through the dark web because...
I thought it just meant that all the web pages had black backgrounds.
No, that's the 1990s.
Ah, but sorry, I was confused.
But since it's on the dark web and since the scientific community are the ones making a lot of use of this, there are things like YouTube tutorials popping up to help people find their way onto the dark web to begin with in order to use Sci-Hub and get hold of this research. So,
wasn't the original domain name sci-hub.org, and didn't that get shut down through the legal process? So now it's sci-hub.io. Mike, you know what the top level domain io is for?
It is the British Indian Ocean Territory.
I knew you would know that, Mike. I have another question you might know the answer to. The recording industry, musicians, they make their money selling their music, and they deserve to make a living making music. I think that's an important part of a progressive society. But a lot of musicians have found with their music just being pirated and shared routinely online, it's harder for them to sell their music, although a lot of musicians still manage to make a living. Is there any way that this Sci-Hub system would cause scientists to not want to do research anymore because their information is being shared in the scientific community? Or is that a really bad analogy?
It seems extremely unlikely to me. The amount of sales of any one scientific paper is probably zero. Like, zero papers are sold at retail, to a very good approximation. But to the degree that it's more than zero, it's not how scientists make their livings. And look, we can talk about what the model should be. I think it's clear that the current model is not the way it should be. We can talk about whether this is an appropriate response to that or not. But the model is, as it exists, is just nuts. It's not supporting science. It's not supporting the scientists. It's just supporting the journal publishers, who in the age of print were providing a very useful service. If you wanted a scientific paper, you had to go to the university library because that's where the scientific papers went. You couldn't have every single scientific paper in your home.
And they were actual papers made of paper.
But now that's not necessary anymore. And I hope a lot of scientists I know are working to change the system because it's really not benefiting the public at large or the scientists themselves. But it's going to take some time,
right? And the journal. I'd like to posit
the opinion that if universities didn't have to pay companies like Elsevier to access all these academic and scientific documents, maybe that would free up more money for research. So I think this is a good thing.
Indeed, and the scientific journal business model is, I think, a good analog to things like the large record company business model or the huge Hollywood studio business model, which are things that are also less and less relevant as technology progresses.
But, and I mean, there's a difference. Like, huge Hollywood studios actually make movies.
This is true.
Large journal publishers do not make science.
This is true. But you can also make a movie yourself and publish it yourself without needing a studio to distribute it for you.
But look, I'm not... If I'm the defender of the entertainment industry on the show, then it's because this is a very weird show. There are things that Hollywood studios can do with millions of dollars that you and I in our apartments with $1,000 cameras cannot do, and we can debate whether it's worth it or not. But like the Hollywood studios actually do something. They do a lot of evil things, but they actually, at the end of the day, occasionally make a movie. And some of them are worth watching. The scientific journal publishers do not do science. They do not fund science. They do not cause science to be done. They are the means by which scientists communicate about their work after they have already done it. And I think that's a very important distinction.
This all bears a lot of thought. And, of course, if anyone is a professional scientist in our listenership, please send us an email, oth@2600.com. And let us know your take on this this whole issue, because we love our diverse band of listeners and hearing from them when their expertise is actually applicable to what we're saying, and we can learn a bit of something ourselves.
If I'm missing something and getting it completely wrong, oth@2600.com, send us an email.
On that note, we're going to take a short break. I'll play you a tune, and then we will continue with our second hour of our special 2-hour edition of Off the Hook.
I walk up to your home, attach your TNI up to my phone. Who I call's unknown, all I know is I'm beige but alone. I freak cell is cloned. Technique is well known. Even so, I do all this. You're calling, call. Let's make all everybody from Paris to the San Fernando Valley. Someday I wish someone would share my hobby to end the freak of war.
That was I Freak Alone by Bonecage. You are listening to WBAI New York. The time is just about 8.02 p.m. And this is not the Personal Computer Show. If you're tuning in for our friends at the PC Show, they have the night off. They'll be returning next week with a two-hour special edition. But for now, you're listening to the second hour of a special edition of our show, which is Off the Hook. And That was a little freaky song dedicated to Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, who I'm sure enjoys his doses of history. So a lot of other stuff going on in the world for us to talk about. I know there was a story about coming out of India that that you know a bit about, Mike.
Yeah, there's some really good news. We've talked about this a bit in the past. This program that Facebook has been sponsoring called Free Basics, which is where people on certain mobile carriers in India were allowed to access selected parts of the internet for free, which sounds like a good deal. But the funny fact, the parts of the internet they were able to access for free, Facebook, which was paying for it. And so if they wanted to get access to the whole internet, then they had to pay extra money for it. And that is zero rating is what that's called, where certain websites are free and others are not. And it is a violation of net neutrality, of course, the principle that all traffic should be treated equally. And there's been a really amazing campaign by some folks in India called Save the Internet, and to oppose zero rating, say that all internet traffic should be treated equally and charged equally. If you want to visit Facebook, that's okay. If you want to visit Twitter, that's okay. If you want to visit your grandmother's website, that's okay. Whatever you want to do on the internet, just pay for the data you use. It's a pretty reasonable principle. And it is now the law in India. Congratulations to the campaigners there. There's a ruling that was published. I don't know the date of this article, but since we were last on the air, by TRAI, the Telecom Regulatory Authority of India, which said zero rating is not allowed in India. There's one weird thing, which is that the fine for violating this is 50,000 rupees a day, which is less than $1,000. So if Facebook really wanted to, they could just pay $1,000 a day. They wouldn't even notice the difference. And it's helpfully capped at 5 million rupees per year, which is less than $10,000, an amount of money that literally Facebook would not even notice missing from their bank accounts if it suddenly disappeared.
I think they have that in their couch.
It's actually $73,500, but probably make that much money in the time it takes Mark Zuckerberg to blink.
Rob says they leave that in their couch. I'm sure they have couches. I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg's couch costs more than that, quite literally. So I hope they do the right thing and back down. But if they really wanted to play hardball, they could. Bernie, you think we'll ever have this kind of rule in the United States?
Well, India is the world's largest democracy. We here in the United States have a constitutional republic. We don't really have a democracy here. And I would love to see something like that happen in this country, where net neutrality is made the law of the land. But apparently the folks in India have one up on us, and they're really this is really amazingly progressive to me that they pulled this off. Are you surprised this happened?
I mean, look, I don't know enough about telecom regulation in India to be surprised or not, but I'm impressed that a public campaign, you know, not everyone in India has the internet. Not everyone in India can care about the internet. There are a lot of people in India for whom something that's got 0 rupees on the price tag seems like a good deal. But I'm impressed that there were enough people who realized that this is a bad deal and rose up and wrote letters and opposed it, were able to get it stopped.
So these are people that were arguing, and a lot of the people don't have internet access in India. They're saying, you know, if our only internet access for free is going to be Facebook, we don't want internet access at all. Is that basically what they're starting out with?
I don't know if they would phrase it quite that way.
Well, but that's what it amounts to. That took a lot of courage. It's like, you know what? It'd be nice to have Facebook along with everything else that's on the internet, but if that's the only thing you're going to give us and you're not going to let us use other stuff, then we're going to wait. We're going to wait until we really have net neutrality and we can access anything on the internet instead of just Facebook. This is really kind of arrogant, I think, of Mark Zuckerberg to like say, all right, we're going to give you free internet, but the only thing you can access is Facebook.
And to be completely clear, there were other websites. They had other partners as part of this, but there were all kinds of bizarre technical rules in the Free Basics program. You were not allowed to use HTTPS, for instance, so that people could spy on your internet traffic if you couldn't afford to pay for internet access. It was really a second-class internet in every conceivable way. And that's what Mark Zuckerberg wanted to give the people of India. And I'm glad that he was stopped.
What else were they would get? They would get Facebook, I think Wikipedia, and maybe one or two other things.
I mean, I don't have a complete list, but among the sites in it was, I want to get the right one. Sorry. I don't want to give blame to the wrong entity. Flipkart, I think, is the one that was included, which is a large internet shopping site in India. Flipkart is
Bing,
the one.
Bing search too.
But
and the weather.
Yeah, but so Flipkart was in it, but their competitors were not. So it was a very clear goal to get people who were just joining the internet to go on Flipkart and to avoid Snapdeal and Amazon and the other their other competitors. And who rightly, a lot of, you know, large Indian internet companies took the very noble position of saying, no, I don't want to be part of this program. Some of the travel sites and other things, you know, lost presumably customers because they said, we do not wish to participate in this unethical program. And so I'm glad that those companies will be able to stick around and compete on a level playing field. And maybe some of those companies will still lose because the marketplace doesn't like them. That's fine. But at least they're able to say, you know, compete on their own merits. Unlike the United States, where T-Mobile in particular, but other carriers are picking and choosing which websites you can visit for free on your phone and charging you money to visit others.
Absolutely. And this is, in a nutshell, like this is an exact example of the arguments we've been having in favor of net neutrality for years and years now. It's always like, for those who still haven't been totally clear on the issue of what net neutrality means, this is what it means. It means stopping carriers like or entities like Facebook with vested business interests in controlling what you can and can't look at on the net, to just basically saying no, that's not cool. You cannot control what people can and can't look at on the net, because that makes it an unlevel playing field for everyone, and it's really shady. I mean, imagine if this had gone through, what it would have been worth to any company to pay Facebook basically a toll to get on the internet that that all these people with free internet would be allowed to look at, and you know, get into that little inner circle. It's scary stuff. It frightens me.
SaveTheInternet.in, which is the entity that really led the charge on this, and I'm incredibly impressed with. They put out a statement after this ruling came down, and they do have they do note two caveats, which is that TRAI, the regulatory agency, has still not ruled on a proposal to block VoIP services like WhatsApp and Viber and Skype that a lot of the telecom providers don't like because it's a lot